If you want to turn to Matthew chapter 6, we'll be beginning there. Of course, we remember and we know that even though there are chapter breaks in our Bibles, many times they're there for our reference and they're helpful in that respect because we're able to say, turn to Matthew chapter 6. But we have to remember that originally it wasn't that way. For example, this is still the middle of Jesus' sermon. And Jesus' sermon didn't have chapters. So, beginning there in chapter 5, his sermon began. And sometime, I know I had some people talked about getting a Bible that doesn't have the chapter breaks. And so they read it through. They read it by the paragraphs and by the sentences instead of by verses. And that's an interesting way to do it. But certainly, it'd be interesting to read through all of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount all together without these chapter breaks breaking it up. Of course, we're not just reading through it. We're actually examining bits and pieces of it. And we're going to do a little bit of that tonight. We touched on a little bit this idea that's here in the beginning of chapter 6 back in chapter 5. But we want to fully look at it. Verse 1, Jesus says, "Take heed that you do not your alms before men to be seen of them, otherwise you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven." Now others' translations may translate that as acts of righteousness or don't be practicing your righteousness. And that's really the idea of the word is literally compassionateness. Don't do your acts of compassion is what he's saying. So these are charitable deeds. These are the things like giving to the poor, helping someone in need. And Jesus warns us not to help the poor. I better not stop there, had I? Not to help the poor in an effort to be seen and praised by others. That's not why we do it. We are to help the poor, but our motivation is very important. Remember, the theme throughout the Sermon on the Mount is about Jesus getting to the heart, the true motivation of why people do what they do. Not just the actions, but the motivations. And we saw that back when he was talking about, they said don't kill, but I'm telling you don't be angry without a cause. They said don't commit adultery, but I tell you don't lust. He's getting back down deep into why we do these things. And when it comes to the things that we might call acts of worship or acts of righteousness or good works, sometimes the New Testament refers to them as. The question is not whether we do those good works. We know we're supposed to do them. But the question is, what is our motivation for doing them? If I'm doing my good works thinking that I'm going to somehow work my way to heaven by doing enough good works, then I've missed what it's all about. If I think that I'm going to do my good works so that everybody else will see me and think, oh, what a holy, righteous person that is, then I've missed the boat. And that's what Jesus is getting across to us here. In verse 2, he goes on to say, "Therefore, when you do your alms, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have received their reward." Can you imagine? I mean, that seems pretty preposterous, doesn't it? Can you imagine somebody coming to church, and when it came time for the collection, they pulled their bugle out of their pocket or their trumpet out of their pocket, and they start going, "Look what I'm giving." That'd be ridiculous, wouldn't it? And yet that's what Jesus said some of those hypocrites in his day were doing. They'd get their trumpet out and blow their trumpets and make a big scene. "Here I come. I'm fixing to give my money to the poor. Look how good I am." Now, we might look at that and we might think, well, we're not like that. And perhaps that's true. But we do still have that temptation from time to time to want to receive some recognition, some honor, some bit of thanks for our charitable deeds that we do. When we help somebody who's in need, we want them to thank us, don't we? We want them to tell everybody, oh, you know, so-and-so helped me out. Wasn't that good of them? Now, we may not go blowing the trumpets, but sometimes we do things because we want some recognition, and we've got to watch out for that attitude. Giving that is done so that others will give praise is hypocritical at its core. It's not sincere. And even though, you know, those folks that blew the trumpets and then dropped their bag of money in the collection or the poor box or wherever they gave it there in the first century, the money still did good. But they had missed out. And those of us today, we may give. And that giving that we do may help others, and others may benefit from it. But we will not benefit with God from it if we're doing it from the wrong motivation. And that's what we have to be careful of. See, the kind of giving that he's talking about here is the kind that wouldn't have been done at all if it weren't for the fact that people were watching. If there weren't people around to see, why, they wouldn't have given that money at all. They wouldn't have given that help or whatever it was. They wouldn't have done it when no one is looking, because they want everyone to see. It kind of reminds me, I've seen this happen after some tragedy, something like Hurricane Katrina or something like the tsunami that hit over in Indonesia or in Japan, and you see on TV these celebrities, right? And they're on the camera and they're giving a big check. Look what I'm doing. And you wonder, would they have given that if the cameras weren't rolling? If everybody wasn't seeing them give that? Now, I know that there are some famous people that are big-hearted givers, and they don't do it for, you know, to be seen, and they don't make a big show of it. But boy, there are some that do. And you wonder, why are they doing that? And we have to ask ourselves that question. Why am I doing this? Am I hoping to get a reward from men or from God? And so we have to watch out for that. If we get our reward from men, then we get that reward. But that's the only reward we get. We're supposed to be, as he says later on down around verse 19, we need to be laying up treasures in heaven, not on earth. And by doing our good deeds so that other people praise us, we've missed the boat. And of course, we saw back in chapter 5 that we are supposed to let our light shine, but not so that men will praise us, but so that men will praise our Father in heaven. A little side note, if we might. Did you notice there in verse 2 that he says, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues? Now, as we're reading the New Testament, of course, if we start in Matthew, this is the first time that the word synagogue or synagogues is used. Now, I remember reading about the tabernacle. And I remember reading about the temple. Well, what's a synagogue? The synagogue is actually mentioned one time in the Old Testament. It's in Psalm 74 and verse 8. It's mentioned nearly 70 times in the New Testament, the synagogues. Where did they come from? It wasn't something from the law of Moses, and yet by Jesus' day, they're all over the place. Do you ever wonder? I mean, do we just read along? Yeah, and he did it at the synagogue, and do we ever wonder? What's a synagogue? Where'd it come from? What is that? Sometimes I wonder when we're reading the Bible, if we even stop to think, what are we reading? There are several things that were virtually non-existent or entirely non-existent in the Old Testament, but that exist in the New Testament, and that were things that got going and got to be popular, got to be famous, or got to be well known during that 400 years between Malachi and Christ. You know, 400 years, things can change a lot, can it? Well, sure it can. 400 years ago, there was no United States of America, and yet here we are today. 400 years, things can change dramatically. And so, where did those things come from? What is it? And how did that come to be? This is just one of those things. Some others that you might be interested in looking into. What about the Pharisees and the Sadducees? They're not mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament. And yet, they're all over the pages of the Gospels. What about the Feast of Dedication or the Sanhedrin? sometimes translated as counsel. Now, studying that time between the Testaments and what happened there, maybe sometime we'll have a lesson just on that. We don't have time to get into it all tonight, but that can help us understand the New Testament better because we understand, well, who are these groups of people? What do they believe? What's the difference in a Pharisee and a Sadducee? And why did Jesus, you know, have all these run-ins with these guys? If we don't know who they were, what they taught, or what they believed, we don't know what they're arguing about. We don't understand what they're discussing. But we'll just deal with the synagogue quickly right now. The synagogue was basically a local place of worship for the times between those times when they went to the temple. And because of the fact that so many of the Jews had gotten so scattered, so far away from Jerusalem, and for a large portion of time there was no temple that they could go to and worship at. And so they worshipped at these synagogues. Now, they didn't offer the sacrifices at the synagogue. They didn't do that. The sacrifices still were made at the temple. But at the synagogue, they would have the Bible reading and Bible study, and they would sing songs, and they would do the same kinds of things that we might do in worship to God today. They would take up the money, take up the collection for the poor, which is what Jesus is talking about here. Now, obviously, they didn't have the Lord's Supper, so they didn't do something like that. But they were there was a group of Jews in a community, and there had to be at least 10, some places, sometimes they say it needed to be 12, as representative of the 12 tribes, that there needed to be 12 men to make a synagogue. And that if there weren't 12, there couldn't be a synagogue. As we get into our study of Philippians a little further on Wednesday night, we'll see there was no synagogue in Philippi because apparently there weren't enough Jews there to have a synagogue. And so the synagogue is often referred to as either the place, the building where they met, or as them coming together to do that. And so it's an interesting thing to learn about those things. And there are other things as well. Well, verse 3 then, Jesus gets back, as we get back to this, he says, "But when you do your alms, let not your left hand know what your right hand is doing." Now, let me ask you a question. Can your right hand or your left hand do something without the other? Can you literally do that? No. But Jesus is using a hyperbole or an exaggeration of events to try to get the point across. And he does that on a number of occasions. Probably one of the most famous is the one about the camel going through the eye of the needle. That's an exaggeration. It's a hyperbole. It's an absurd situation that calls attention to what the real message is. And here, the real message is, you don't do it to make a scene. You don't try to be seen doing this thing. You make it a secret thing. It's a private thing. You can't literally do that. It's a figure of speech. Our giving is supposed to be between us and God. That's what our giving is about. Now, I want to mention that some people have taken this verse and they've said, well, you know, you can't use a check when you give to the church then because then somebody will know what you gave because your name's on the check. And some people have said, well, you know, even the elders in a church shouldn't know how much somebody's giving because that would violate this scripture. And they would even say, well, you know, you shouldn't take that tax exemption for that tax deduction for charitable giving on your income taxes because that violates this scripture. Remember the principle that Jesus is teaching. Don't do it to get the praise of men. Now somebody writing a check and putting it in the collection plate is not trying to get the praise of men. They're just doing their bookkeeping. Someone who takes the tax exemption, there's not praise with that. They're just trying to be good stewards of their money and try to account for it and take that tax deduction so that they can give more in the future. Because if we don't, you know, we have less to give if it all gets taxed away from us. And, of course, certainly for the leadership of the church, for the elders particularly of a church who are watching for the souls of the members, one of the things they need to watch for is covetousness and greed and things like that. And sometimes that shows up in the way that someone gives. So there again, it's not a matter of doing it for the praise of men. It's not that kind of giving. And so Jesus' principle that he's teaching here is not violated by those things. So we need to understand that. Now, on the other hand, if somebody wrote their check out for the church and made a copy of it and published it in the newspaper with a heading on it, "Look how great I am because I gave this much," well, that would be a bit of a problem then, wouldn't it? That would violate the principle that Jesus is getting at here. So we need to remember the principle that he's teaching and what it really is getting at. And it gets at the motivation for why we're doing these things. Then in verse 4, he goes on to say that your alms may be in secret, and your Father which sees in secret himself shall reward you openly. Now, of course, when we think about secrecy, it's obvious from the rest of Scripture, and that's where we always have to look at the whole context of the New Testament to get the full picture of things. It's obvious from the rest of Scripture that he's not talking about total secrecy here. Do you know somebody in the first century church who gave a lot of money to the church? I do. Do we know his name? Barnabas. We read about it. If we read the book of Acts, we'll read about how Barnabas had some land and he sold that land and he took the money and he gave it. But was he doing it to get the praise of men? No. No, that wasn't his motivation. He didn't make a big scene out of it. He just did it, took it and gave it to the apostles. Here's some money to help the poor. But guess what? He did it secretly, you might say. I mean, you know, He went and gave it to the apostles, so it wasn't total secret. The apostles knew where it came from. But he did it secretly, so to speak. And God rewarded him openly, didn't it? God wrote about it in the Bible so that all generations would know what he did. But he wasn't doing it to be seen of men. Now, there was another couple who did do their giving to get the praise and honor from men. Do we remember their names? Yeah, they're in that very next chapter, Ananias and Sapphira, aren't they? Well, they got their reward too, but it wasn't the one they were hoping for. Because in the process of trying to get that praise and honor of men, not only did they have the wrong motivation, but they lied about it to God as well. And so, it's not the factor of total secrecy, but it's a matter of the thoughts and intents of the heart. And that's what God always judges us by, is the thoughts and intents of our heart in conjunction with the actions that we then take. All right, verse 5. Jesus moves on from alms to prayer. The same teaching, the same principle is still here. Don't make a scene out of it. Notice he says in verse 5, when you pray, do not be as the hypocrites are, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues. There's those synagogues again that we never heard of before until we read here. And in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. Now again, some people say, well, Jesus is saying we shouldn't have public prayer. Is that what Jesus is saying? I mean, we just had a prayer a little while ago. We're going to have another one to close out. When you're out at a restaurant and you're going to eat, you shouldn't pray over your meal because you're in public. Is that what Jesus is saying? That's not what he said. He said, don't do it to be seen of men. We've got to remember that even though we sometimes call prayer and giving and other things, we may call them acts of worship, when we do them, we should not be acting. We may call them acts, but we should not be acting. These are to be sincere actions taken from a pure and sincere heart. And so Jesus is not condemning all public prayer. It's the purpose of being seen by men and being praised by men that's being condemned. In fact, Jesus himself prayed in public on several occasions. In fact, just a few verses down, he gives a sample prayer, which I don't know if you'd say he prayed that or not, but he tells them to pray this way. But then later on, We see him when he raises Lazarus from the dead. We see at the feeding of the 5,000. We see at the Last Supper. And of course there, it's just him and the disciples. But still, he's not alone. There are others present. And yet he prays on all those occasions. Well, what did Paul say? I will therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting holy hands to God without wrath and doubting. So we are to pray anywhere and everywhere we need to pray, but we don't go make a scene out of it. We don't get on national TV and say, everybody watch me pray. No, that's not the point. And Jesus is trying to get us to understand why we do something is just as important, in fact, in many cases, more important than the thing that we did. We can do the right thing, but if we've done it for the wrong reasons, we've still failed. Well, verse 6 then, because we see this in verse 6, he says, but when you pray, enter your closet, and when you have shut the door, pray to your Father which is in secret, and your Father which sees in secret shall reward you openly. Does Jesus really want us to go hide in the closet to pray? Well, the word here actually can just mean a private room. You know, someone might have, you know, maybe their bedroom, or maybe some people have a study in their house even, or something like that. He's just saying, go in private with God when you need to talk to God. And you know, we talked about, we had a public prayer a little while ago, and I led that particular prayer, which occasionally I do when there's not someone else to lead it. But there are many things in a public prayer with all of us here that I don't want to tell everybody, but that I might need to talk to God about privately. You ever have things like that that you don't necessarily want everybody else to know everything that's going on in your thoughts and in your life? It's not something for public viewing, but it's something you need to talk to God about privately. You need to pray to Him. It's a sad thing if there is a man who only prays in public at the worship of the saints and doesn't pray to God privately on his own time. That's a sad situation. Because certainly we are to pray without ceasing. We're not just to pray on Sunday morning and Sunday night at church. We're to pray to God at all hours of the day and night. Well, then Jesus goes on to admonish concerning the use of vain repetition, meaningless, useless repetitions. Now, not all repetitions are vain. Paul asked for his thorn in the flesh to be removed 3 times. Jesus also prayed in the garden 3 times. And in fact, Mark 14:39, when he's asking for the cup to pass from him, he prays 3 times, and Mark 14:39 says he used the same words. In other words, he repeated himself. But that wasn't vain repetition, because the Hebrew writer tells us that he was heard in what he prayed. A perfect example of vain repetition, though, is in 1 Kings 18:26. We talked this morning about Elijah and those false prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. Well, they were a good example of some vain repetition. It says that from morning to noon, now I don't know how early in the morning they got started, but from in the morning time all the way till noon, so 2, 3, 4 hours, I don't know how long, I don't know exactly when they started, but all that time they cried, O Baal, hear us. For hours, just saying the same thing over and over and over again, a meaningless chant. Of course, in their case, it was entirely meaningless because Baal's not a real god. Baal couldn't hear them if he wanted to because he doesn't exist. But Jesus points this out, that vainly saying the same thing over and over again. Sometimes in this connection, we might think phrases that we may say in a prayer that really have no meaning to us. There's a story told of the man who used to always pray. Every time he'd lead the closing prayer at church, as he's going along, he would say, "And Lord, remove the cobwebs from our minds and hearts." And he, time and time again, "Lord, remove the cobwebs from our minds and hearts." And And after several years of this, finally, as he was praying this prayer again, and he got to that point, and he prayed that section of his prayer again, someone said, "Lord, just kill the spider." Sometimes we say phrases just over and over again, and we really don't even think about what they mean. Or maybe they don't really mean anything to us. They're maybe just something that we've always said, or something that we've heard said, and we picked up from someone else. So we need to be sure that when we're praying, our prayers come from a sincere heart. And that they're from the heart, not just a repetition of something we heard somebody else pray. We need to be praying for the things that actually mean something to us. We have to remember that the person who prays the loudest, the longest, or even the prettiest prayer is not necessarily the one that's closest to God. Sometimes we get very impressed by somebody who prays a prayer with lots of pretty flowery language. Well, and I don't know. I mean, certainly, I'm sure some of those people who pray beautiful prayers are very close to God. But you know, some people may just be really good at praying pretty prayers. Say that three times fast. Praying pretty prayers. That's a tongue twister. But you know, some people may be good at that. They're just eloquent with their words, but their heart may be far from Him. Jesus said, "This people draws nigh to me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." And some people may be in that same boat. And Jesus concludes this section in verse 8. He says, "Be not therefore like unto them, for your Father knows what things you have need of before you ask Him." He explains that the purpose of prayer is not to tell God something. It's not to inform God of something. God already knows. He knew what we wanted before we even asked it. Isaiah 65:24, He says, "Before they call, I will answer. And while they are still speaking, I will hear." He said, I'm going to answer their prayer before they even ask it because I know what they need. And that's the way God works. Prayer is not for God's benefit. It's for our benefit. He didn't create it because He needed billions of people to talk to Him. He invented the lifeline of prayer because He knew that we needed to come to Him. Not because He needed us to tell Him everything. Prayer helps us recognize our need for God and helps us develop a spirit of gratitude for His blessings. Through prayer, we learn to ask for the right things and learn to submit to God's will for us in our lives. We learn to ask for things and get a no and deal with that and accept that God doesn't want us to have something that we want us to have at times. All right, now I'm going to do something a little unorthodox here. We're going to skip some verses down to verse 16. We're going to come back to what, you know, because we're almost out of time, so we don't have time to deal with this sample prayer in its entirety right now. We'll get back to that. So we'll skip down to verse 16 because it's still the same theme. Don't make a big show out of things. And in verse 16, he talks about something else. He talks about fasting. He deals with this in the same way that he deals with these other acts of worship, giving and prayer. Puts it on an equal par with them. And yet I wonder, how many Christians have practiced fasting as a worship to God, as honoring God through submitting to that? Well, he says it's not to be done to make everybody feel sorry for you or look at, you know, how he says here in verse 16, "Moreover, when you fast, do not be as the hypocrites of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear unto men to fast. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward." Can you imagine somebody say, "Oh, I'm just so hungry. I'm fasting today, and I haven't had a bite to eat all day long. Oh, woe is me, poor me." And so, you know, they get everybody sympathy. Oh, you must be so holy. You're giving up food to, you know, you're trying to get closer to God. And that's what they're looking for. And Jesus says, that's not what it's all about. It's not to be done to make everybody feel sorry for you. Talk about how devoted you must be. Unfortunately, though, today in the church, and in fact in all the denominational world too, you throw it in there, but fasting is almost completely ignored or forgotten about. Very few practice it, and very few have ever even attempted it one time, much less practicing it on a regular basis. In fact, in the church today, we've entirely replaced fasting with feasting a lot of times, I think. It's all about food. We can't do anything without food. And yet, Jesus talked about that. Now, it's interesting as we look here in verse 16, notice that Jesus says, when you fast. He makes an assumption there. By using the word when, he didn't say if you fast, he said when you fast. He assumed that his followers would fast. Now, they weren't fasting at that time. On one occasion, the Pharisees came up to him, how come your disciples aren't fasting? And the disciples of John came and asked, the Pharisees fast and John's disciples fast. How come your disciples aren't fasting? And he said, well, they can't fast while the bridegroom's with them, but when the bridegroom goes away, then they're going to fast. So he said there was a time coming that they were going to practice fasting, and we see it all through the New Testament church. Fasting is a very common thing. In fact, we've talked about giving. Fasting is mentioned far more often than giving in the New Testament. We've talked about singing. Fasting is mentioned far more often than singing in the New Testament. And yet it's been completely neglected and ignored. Again, we don't have time to fully deal with the whole subject of fasting tonight, but we do want to touch on this just briefly as what he said. Fasting was an important part of the first century Christianity that we have not fully restored in the 21st century. In verse 17, he says, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face. He points out that proper fasting will not interfere with personal grooming. You brush your teeth, you wash your face, you comb your hair. You take care of yourself. Because, see, fasting is about exerting spiritual control over the physical body. It's not about neglecting the body. That's not what it's all about. And so, he points that out. And then in verse 18, he says, the reason you do that is so that you don't appear unto men to fast, but unto your Father which is in secret. And again, your Father which sees in secret shall reward you openly. God will reward us when we do things for His glory instead of for our own glory. Isn't that what Jesus said He came to do? He said, I glorify not myself. I do the will of my Father which is in heaven. My Father which sent me. That's why He came to this earth, to do what the Father commanded. You see, the reward is either a reward in this life by the praise and honor of mankind and other people, or the praise and reward of God. We can't have both. So we're going to have to pick one. Well, see, the praise and glory and honor from men is fleeting. Because it's a fashionable thing to do that, and then that fad passes and people move on. I'm amazed, and I know this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with these specific things, but I am amazed as I watch how quickly the fads come and go. The feathers in the hair, the ladies were wearing the feathers in their hair, and boy, that was all the rage for about 2 months, maybe three, and then they were all on half price at Walmart, because they couldn't get rid of them because it wasn't that there was some new thing then that became cool. See, that's the way if we're trying to please men and women for that matter, but mankind, human beings, if that's our goal, if that's what we're after, we're going to fail miserably because their standards change constantly. What pleases them changes constantly. What makes them excited changes constantly. But you see, if we want to please God, God is constant. what will please him today is the same thing that pleased him 500 years ago, and it'll be the same thing that'll please him in another 500 years if the earth remains that long. Because God is constant, and we can trust him. So if we try to please men, we're going to utterly fail eventually. We can't keep it up. That's what happens to these churches that try to please men. They try to be popular with people, and they are for a little while, until some other church somewhere down the street offers something more exciting, and then off they go. Let's see if we stick with God. We don't have to be flashy or exciting. We just have to keep plugging along and doing what God has said to do. How about you in your life? Have you been doing things to be seen of others? Or are you doing things because you love the Lord and you want to bring glory to Him? Because you want Him to be pleased with you. You can please others or you can please your Father. While we were at that camp, on one occasion, I had called Abigail to come. There was a particular room upstairs, part of this gym area there, and I had called her to come down to me, and she didn't come. And so I had to go up after her. And when I got up there, I said, "I called you to come down. Why didn't you come down when I called you?" And she said, "Well, so-and-so told me that I should come with them, and they wouldn't be my friend if I didn't." That's tough, isn't it? I mean, maybe you were never there, but that's tough. You know, they said they wouldn't be my friend if I didn't come. Well, I told her, it's more important to be obedient to your Father than it is to have a friend. I know she doesn't believe that, probably. But when it comes to our Heavenly Father, that's certainly true. There will be people of the world that will say, "Hey, if you'll do this, you'll be our friend. And if you don't do that, we're not going to be friends with you." But it's more important for us to be obedient to our Father in heaven than to have friends on this earth. And that's hard sometimes, because we like to have friends. But sometimes that may be a sacrifice that we have to make. Some people in the Bible did have to make those kinds of sacrifices. If you have a need to respond tonight, either because you haven't been doing the things that you should to please God, or because you have been doing things to please men, whatever your need may be, please respond as we stand and as we sing.